Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio, and tonight we're going to be talking about addiction, breaking the silence, and treating the disease. And I've got a guest with me tonight. I need to unblock his microphone here, but yeah, Mark, a recovering addict, is going to be talking with us tonight about addiction and recovery. And Mark, I think you're live on the air. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Frater. How about you?
Okay, not bad. Just still getting the hang of this Blog Talk Radio. I've only done it for a few months, and they've been changing the whole setup here. But hey, not
what
bad.
What music?
Yeah, was a little bit of music I found on Magnatunes, and as a service that provides music for podcasts like this, and yeah, I just love that. Kind of down-home Cajun-style music. Dirty blues for your dirty mind, call it.
There you go.
Yeah, oh boy. Oh, well, tonight, you know, usually on this show I talk about theological topics, and sometimes I get kind of, I don't know, just kind of too cerebral. So this broadcast, I thought we'd just dedicate it to help, self-help, wellness, recovery. And our topic in particular is addiction. And, you know, when it comes to addiction, it just seems, I know looking back when I was kind of struggling to go, you know, even just a few days without relapsing, and, you know, my drug of choice was alcohol, and it just seemed hopeless. You know, I didn't know, people would tell me, well, all you have to do is stop. You know, all you have to do is just not do it anymore. And, you know, my reaction would be, well, yeah, that seems obvious, but how in the world do you do that? And mm-hmm. It just seems, mm-hmm. I know in my case, you know, just put everybody close to me through hell, and I felt like I was going through hell as well. And it was just like they say, a baffling illness or just a baffling disease.
Cunning, and I can't remember the last one, but
cunning, baffling, and powerful, that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
And I think that just about sums it up, because I know with me anyway, I knew I shouldn't be doing it, but there was a part of me that said I had to. I mean, I just felt like it was a like a matter of life and death.
I can relate to that. The people that, at least in my program, it's like, hey, stopping's the easy part. Staying stopped, that's the, well, I won't say the word I use, but yeah, you can, that's the tricky part. I know people in my 12-step program, you know, they'll come in and, I got 1 day of sobriety, or I got 3 days. Well, you got the stopping part down. It's, you got to work on that staying stopped, and that's where the 12 steps come in. But I guess we'll get to that just a little bit later.
Yeah. And that's where, gosh, you know, the programs that we have, you know, the 12-step programs, with me it was AA, and gosh, with me it was kind of like AA and online AA, because, mm-hmm. you know, I was struggling with trying to overcome my addiction for probably about 30-some years before I finally got it right and got quit and stayed quit. But I was in and out of physical face-to-face AA groups. And then finally, you know, I stumbled across an online AA group that had a couple of folks in there I could really relate to, and we would chat through email over the internet. And that last time, you know, something just clicked. And yeah. I could really relate. But, you know, without the programs, you know, I don't imagine how folks do it. I don't know how folks do it.
Well, some of them just aren't addicts. They may be abusing alcohol, or they may be, you know, they go out once a year and get plastered and then can go for another year and not do it. And that's not addiction. That's just getting drunk. And then others abuse it, can put it down, and maybe come back to it. But the addict, they can't stop it. You know, one drink is too many and 50's not enough.
Yeah, and you can't stop without help. You know, that's you do need a program of recovery, I think, whatever that may be, whatever form that may take, you know, in order to stop and stay quit. And, And, you know, I was thinking kind of along the topic of the disease being powerful, cunning, baffling, and all that, we had some poor guy in our church back when I was the pastor. And I'm going to let a dirty secret out right now. I was the pastor and I was drinking. And that's, you know, I was in the church setting when I finally decided or finally knew it was time to quit. But we had this one poor guy, his family was a pillar of the church, and they didn't believe in AA. They didn't believe in any of that stuff. They figured if you're sick, you know, the church has got to try to help you, or you've got to try to help yourself, or the doctors have got to try to help you, but they didn't believe in a 12-step program.
Uh-huh.
You know, and this one guy, he would just try everything. He would come up in the front of the church and, you know, throw his weed and his cigarettes right at the front of the altar and say, with the help of Jesus, I'm going to quit this day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd hold him and just knew that without a 12-step program, you know, he probably wasn't going to find recovery. And that's
absolutely
the sad thing is that in his case, he never did. Yeah, the family buried him about 4 years ago. But, you know, he tried to do it on his own.
I've been at that altar more than one time, but my, not to get into too much detail, my drug of choice is a behavioral addiction rather than a substance abuse issue. But I was, you know, like I said, went to the altar, you know, Jesus, take this. Jesus, take the wheel. Not realizing that Jesus didn't know how to drive. You know, he didn't have a car back. You know. But finally, when I got into the program and could call, if you'll pardon the expression, a spade, what my actual problem was, then it actually started to click. I mean, if you're dancing around the elephant in the room, that's not going to get you anywhere. So, you know, if your, you know, member of your church was an alcoholic and they're saying, oh, no, he just is sick or what is it? No, he needs the programs. Now, there are a lot of 12-step programs out there that aren't just, I guess AA may be the only one for alcoholics. I'm not sure. But, I mean, there's a ton of them out there. You name your addiction, they're out there. You know, you just got to open it. Well, we don't have phone books anymore. Get online and look for them because they're out there. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, you can just Google them and find whatever your particular problem is. Yeah, you can find a 12-step group for that. Yeah, and
I kind of had a thought there, and I just suddenly lost it. But okay, I've got it back here. Yeah, I think when you're talking about like a behavioral addiction, and then with me with a substance abuse problem, I think one of the first things that people think is that it's a moral issue or mm-hmm. it's a lifestyle choice. You know, they don't really think of it as being an addiction and addiction as being a form of an illness. And
I guess.
Yeah.
Well, for me, I mean, I get people sometimes that think they're being cute and go, oh, you got the addiction to have. And I'm like, would you walk up to an alcoholic with a bottle of bourbon and say, here's the addiction to have? No, of course not. It's like, you know, it doesn't matter what the addiction is, whether it's gambling, alcohol, sex, shopping, power, whatever. If you got the addiction and you're in the hell of the addiction, it's not the addiction to have. You know, it's the one want to get rid of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, folks are looking and they're thinking, boy, you know, that guy's having fun. But, you know, it's not fun when you have no control over it.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that's what people don't really understand.
Yeah, and then the other part of it is, no matter how many times you try and stop or the consequences, I mean, you get caught by your wife coming in at 3 in the morning and she busts you and you go right back out and do it the next day after swearing up and down you're never going to do it again. You know, that's another big part of addiction is no matter what the consequences are, you go right back out and do it again. And
right.
You know, I've been down that path.
Yeah, you know, when you're on that path too, you really don't understand it. I mean, being confronted by your loved ones and trying to explain, you know, why you were doing it. You know, don't you know this is wrong? You're killing yourself. You're destroying your family and blah, yada yada yada. And of course, on one level, I could understand all that, but on another level, I couldn't understand how in the world I was going to quit and stay quit. And I'd make promises saying, oh, yeah, I'm never going to do this again. And then just a few days later, be right back out there doing that again.
Yep. I know. It's the same with me. And it was like I'm a lousy liar. And so, you know, trying to hide anything. Like I say in meetings, if I'd been in Dallas when Kennedy was shot and I was Lee Harvey Oswald, the first thing I would have done when I got out of the building is ran up to the first police officer and said, I did it. You know, I mean, that's how bad I am at trying to hide anything. I mean, the wife can go right through it and you know.
Yeah, I realize, okay, busted.
Yeah, busted.
Mark, do you feel that addiction is a disease? I didn't really ask that question to start out with.
Yeah, I do. Exactly what it is, whether the wiring in my head is screwed up or whether I was born with it, don't know. But really, does it matter? I mean, I've got it, and I've got it till, you know, I take my last breath. And that's a big thing, I mean, I don't know if you've got the commercials where you're at with the passages place where the guy comes on there and says, I used to be an addict, now I'm not. I'm like, I just want to throw something at the TV.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, either you're lying or you never were an addict, you know.
Yeah, I've seen that. Well, he's selling a recovery program that looks like a star hotel.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You see all the beautiful people in there. You don't see the ones that are at the AA meetings looking like they just came in from a 4-day bender, you know.
Yeah, it's like I always wanted to be able to say that, you know, back when I was using, that, you know, I'm no longer an addict, but, you know, now I've been straight for almost 8 years, and I know very much I am an addict.
Me too. I've been in my program. It'll be 3 years in November, and, I'm an addict. I qualify, and I'll keep qualifying, and you know, just because my addiction right now isn't active doesn't mean I don't still do things, you know, as coping mechanisms as I did in my addiction. So, I mean, it's not, it's just there waiting to, you know, come up and bite me. And I'm like, I'm standing there, I don't know, with a club trying to, you know, nope, you're not getting up there, you're not doing it, but, you know, it's day by day, so.
Right. But, you know, with me kind of viewing it as a disease does kind of help in that if you know generally, you know, something's wrong and it's not necessarily, you know, you. I mean, in a way it is, but in another way it's not. It's like it's not that I'm a bad person. It's just that I have this illness. And if I learn how to manage the illness, I can have a great life.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know, if I don't know what's going on, I don't know how to manage the illness, or I don't even try to manage the illness, then, you know, it's just one day of hell after another day of hell.
And
viewing it as a disease did kind of help me face it down and decide it was time to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like I said, those who, you know, like we were talking about earlier, the ones that, go into churches and think they can be healed or cured or delivered. We have a saying, the only thing cured is ham. And that's true. I mean, you know, it's like, if you think that, you know, somebody's going to lay hands on you and boom, 2 seconds later, you're never going to want to practice your addiction again. I got news for you. You will. Because I remember going out, you know, oh, hey, I'm delivered on this, and 6 or 7 hours later, oh, crap, I just blew that, didn't I? So, oh, yeah.
I'm not healed anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, but that's one of, I remember a guy in a group I used to go to. He's gone now, but... Oh, gosh, he had 30-some years of sobriety when he died. And he always said, you know, I've reached that point of being the grateful drunk, where in the beginning, you know, he knew he had the disease. He didn't know why. He hated it. He was miserable. But then after being in the program and following the steps and developing a spirituality that worked, he just became grateful. He could understand why he would have this disease. And the way he put it is that, you know, God allowed me to have this disease so I could make spiritual discoveries that the average person, you know, isn't aware is even possible. That he used to feel sorry when I was talking to him for the normal people out there, the folks that were not addicted. And he said, need a program for them.
Normal anonymous. Oh boy. Those are the ones who think they're normal. That's the thing you got to remember there, Fred. It's we're normal. Normal's a cycle on the washing machine, guys. There's nobody normal out there. Certainly nobody in my family. But yeah, and it's the grateful drunk. I kind of like that. I'm nowhere near, 30 years sobriety, but in the year and it's about 16 months now, I've learned a lot. Like I said, I'm not, what's the expression? I'm not where I was, but thank God.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not where I'm at, but thank God I'm not where I was. And that's the truth, because God, I was a mess. Oh, and you can, I look back at that and try and remember what it was like. So I don't do that again, you know. I may make other mistakes, but I don't want to make that one again.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of the program, I think, whatever program we work. Well, the 12 steps is that, we make a growth one day at a time. We focus on one day at a time. And, we just focus on getting better. And each day that we don't use, we get better. Yeah.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. And at least, I guess it's for every addict, there's the problem of finding something to fill that space. Whether you're used to going to the casino and dropping $10,000 a night, going to the strip clubs and dropping $10,000 a night, or, drinking $10,000 a night. Once, you know, you start trying to get sober and get some recovery, it's like, oh, my God, there's this big, huge hole. What do I do? And I said, you know, I got to fill it with something or I'm going to, you know, be right back where I started. And, of course, you know, I don't do anything just small. I couldn't find one little book to read. I had to tackle the Wheel of Time series, all 14 books. I got through them, though. Lost my sobriety about halfway through it. But then when I came back, I mean, you know. But I got through the monsters.
Wow, that's a lot of reading.
Yeah, and about the last three books I read in 6 weeks, I was determined to get through those puppies because I was like, I want to know how this thing ends so I can move on to something else, anything.
Oh, but yeah, that's it. You got to fill your time with something. And that's where, you know, a lot of the old timers in the groups I would go to would say, come to meetings. You know, hang out here. If you don't have anything else to do, just stay at the meeting hall all day long.
Yeah.
You know, and focus on that. Yeah, in my case, I hit upon the idea of meditation. And I don't know what told me. Nobody really told me in any of the groups I had been in earlier, but I just felt that, you know, this is a something I need to be doing. So I would get up in the morning. I was a guy that used to get up real early to drink. And I'd get up at 4 in the morning, but instead of drinking, I would set up a candle and a little bit of music and just meditate for an hour. And then get up, breakfast, go on my day. And a lot of my recovery was internet-based. You know, the groups that I participated in were online, so when I wasn't working, when I wasn't meditating, I'd be in the chat room just kind of talking with folks and small talk. A lot of it was just small talk. And I think that was some of the best counseling that I had was when a person would get online when I was having a problem and would just say, hey, you know, you're going to get through this. Just hang in there. And what do you think about this, that, and the other thing? And just chit-chat about small stuff. It's not like we have to get in there and analyze the disease. It's just, you know, work the program to the best of your ability.
And the other thing that the disease loves to do is isolate, or you isolate because of the disease. But you put yourself in a room. You're a mushroom. You're in a room, and they feed you crap in the dark. That's what it was.
Right.
And half of the battle is to get it out in the open. I mean, you walk into, in your case, an AA meeting, and the first time you walk in there, you're scared half to death. But the words, for example, just use me, Mark, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, those words come out. And the first couple of times, you're like, oh, my God, I'm so sick. But after that, it's like, okay, so I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'm still here. I haven't dropped dead, and they're not throwing rocks at me. So, you know, they're about as sick as I am.
You know, and also, too, you know, oh, God, my first few meetings when I had to try to think and relate, you know, some of the stuff that I had done under the influence, you know, I thought it was terrible. And some of these guys would just be nodding their heads and smiling and just saying, yeah, been there, done that too. Just a tremendous relief to know that you're not the only sick person in the world.
That's absolutely true, because in our program, I mean, you know, the newcomers that come in there and, well, I've done this and I've done that, and about eight of us are sitting there, nodding our heads. Been there, done that. My wife caught me. Yep, been there, done that. Yep. She's going to kill me. Well, maybe not quite that bad. If you need to hide someplace, don't come to my house. You know? But, I mean, you know, they know that. Yeah. But there are people, one or two that I can think of in my group locally, that don't get it. They don't want to work the program, and for the life of me, I can't figure out why they're there. Now, they'll talk about every other issue they have or every other addiction they have. They may be at Emotions Anonymous or this, but our program, it's like, why are you here? Do you want recovery and sobriety in this program or not? You know, it drives me crazy because the ones that do and are working it, it's like these people are kind of an insult to them. You know, it's like, hey, just come in here and think it's a social club, and it's not a social club.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's pretty serious stuff. We got to work through something that really could kill you.
Yeah, in some moments, we can crack up and be, you know, crazier than a Monty Python skit, and then in the very next second, deadly serious. And my sponsor, the first time he did this, I mean, I was shaken up by it because he was talking, you know, clowning around, and then he gets to the point where he was going to take his granddaughter to the park or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he broke down because he's like, without this program, I couldn't have done that. You know, this program made this possible, and my recovery made it possible. My wife now, you know, believes me, you know, and uh-huh. believes in me and all this. And I was just like, this is my sponsor, and he's crying? You know, and I mean, you know, later on we talked about it. I got to keep it real, and he does keep it real, and that, I hope, keeps me real, so.
Yes, yes. Yeah, but that's a great feeling when you realize, you know, how far you've come and what the program has done for you.
Yeah. I mean,
and you were saying earlier about those folks that played around with the program. I was one of them. I spent about 20 or 30 years just messing around, going in and out of meetings and thinking, well, you know, this is neat, but whatever it is these guys have, I don't have it, at least not that bad, and just thinking I could go back out and drink and have fun. And later, it took me a long time to realize that I couldn't. But, you know, what I found is one benefit to having had that exposure early on to AA is that I ran across some really great people that just would fill my head with just basic common sense and just their experience, strength, and hope. And what they were doing, I didn't realize, but they were planting seeds. And when I was resisting the program, they were still trying to get it through to me. And, of course, the seed didn't take root or anything. But finally, when I was finally beaten down enough to where I realized I really had to quit or just give up on life. And when I made that decision that, okay, this is the time to quit, it was almost like I call it Casey in my head. This old guy who was very patient with me and who died before a few years before I finally got into recovery, I could literally hear his voice talking to me in my head saying, you know, giving me the wisdom, the strength, the courage that I needed at that point in my life to finally get it right. And I knew that he wasn't there, but buried in that subconscious, he was talking to me. And just that's what I think now when I hear of folks that are hanging around the meeting halls, not taking it seriously, joking around. I'm just hoping that the seed is being planted and maybe someday when they're at their wit's end, you know, they'll have that stuff playing in the back of their subconscious too, be able to grasp it.
The rewards of this are, you know, absolutely amazing because, I mean, you know, in our program we have progressive victory over our, you know, addiction. And I couldn't understand what in the world that meant. You know, I'm like, huh? You know, I just thought you stopped it. And shortly, about 3 months after I got into recovery, there was an instance that came up. And my wife questioned what I had done. You know, we had a little argument, and I left the room, and she questioned me about what I had done, thinking that I'd gone back, you know, to my addiction. And I said, I was in the living room reading, you know, the book. And she's like, you weren't, you know, doing whatever. I'm like, why would I do that? Oh, yeah, the addiction thing. Okay, now I remember. No, I'm doing it. And that was a progressive victory right there. It was like, holy crap. I mean, 3 months ago, I would have been on the computer, you know, doing stuff that I don't need to be doing. You know, and now it's like, you know, I get in stressful situations. The thoughts may come into my head, but they kind of just go in and out. It's like, oh, okay.
Yes.
I mean, if I can go through a very stressful weekend like last weekend and only have that thought one day out of three, and it was only maybe 10 seconds, that's a lot better than acting on it and being messed up for 3 days. So.
Yeah, I like that. Progressive victories, yeah. Yeah, in our groups, the guys would talk about, you know, cravings and facing down the cravings and, you know, just having a lessening of the cravings. You know, small victories, I think it's kind of what they would call it. But, you know, that's a great feeling, though, when you're able to get around, you know, into situations that would normally would have been deal breakers in the past, just leading you back to your addictive behavior, and then just be able to realize that, you know, I'm getting some power over this. It's not not as tempting as what it used to be. And I would, God, when I was first in AA trying to get clear of drinking, somebody would talk about drinking whiskey, and God, I could taste the stuff in my mouth. Just, I hadn't been drinking that day, but just him bringing that memory back up, I could literally taste it. And I would always kind of wonder, you know, will I get to the point in my recovery where I'm no longer craving the substance? And it took me a few years, but I finally got to the point where I can be around folks that are drinking. I don't like to be around folks that are drinking because, I don't know, it just raises a lot of unpleasant memories. But I myself am no longer tempted, to pick up a bottle and join them. Great little progressive victory there.
Yeah. Well, there's another story that, drives this thing home. I got remarried, it'll be 5 years ago in November. And to say that my stepson and I didn't get along is like saying the Democrats and the Republicans don't get along. I mean, it was World War III, you know, 90% of the time. And a couple of years ago, that's been the last year, when I finally got recovery and we started having a relationship that we weren't trying to kill each other. It was more, actually respect each other. That kid even says he loves me. I'm like, where did that come from? And then about 3 months ago, Goldfinger, the old James Bond movie, was playing up in Oklahoma City. And we went, because he's a huge Bond fan. Well, he's got this crazy idea that Daniel Craig is the ultimate Bond, and we all know Sean Connery is, but that's neither here nor there. And we went up there, and we watched it and had a great time. And the best part of it was we pranked his mother, got on the phone and came up with this wild story. And she kept believing us, even after we told her it was bogus. And finally, she's like, you are dead. You wanted me to have a closer relationship with him, not at my expense. I'm like, well. the whole thing is, the program made it possible. That's the point.
Yeah, here, it's all focusing on recovery. And, you know, some folks have those beautiful experiences like you've just described. And you know, I thought, God, that I had done everything in my power with my addiction to really drive my family away from me. But, you know, we've come back together, and it's great. But I've also heard guys in AA just talking about, you know, they've been so miserable, so rotten, so terrible, that their family just never does forgive them. And there's just one old guy I'm remembering, it just said, you know, I was a real son of a bitch, and I'm still a son of a bitch, but I'm a sober son of a bitch, and it's great for this son of a bitch to be here.
that reminds me. I mean, early on, I went to AA meetings, because they're just, like, right down the street. And, I mean, those boys are crusty. I mean, in our program, we don't dance around the issue, but we, you know, we don't. Yeah, every once in a while you get a son of a bitch in there, but I mean expression. Well, actually there are a few of those too, but you know in AA, I mean first I went to that meeting and it's like, yeah, I'm a son of a bitch and I left my blankety blank suitcase with the vodka bottle back in Washington and all this stuff, and I'm just like, well, they don't dance around the issue now, do they?
No, they're getting right to it.
They can't afford to. I mean, you've got people in there with cirrhosis of the liver, and you know, this is life and death, literally.
Literally, yes. And that's a sobering thought, too, is that some folks do not find recovery, and, you know, they do. They succumb to that. But, you know, it's just in the program we find some folks that have reached that point of being the grateful addict, and then others that are sober, you know, 20, 30 years, but it's just a sober son of a bitch. And we have both kinds, you know, both types.
Yeah, they call them the dry drunk, and that's what they call it in our program. My sponsor, I mean, the guy, to see where, I mean, I don't want to know what he was like when he was out, you know, out in the world doing research, as he calls it. But, you know, early on when I got this, I called it this round of sobriety because, you know, I could screw it up after I get off the phone here, you know, for all I know. But he was like, Mark, how serious are you about your recovery? And he had to drill that into my head one or two times. Excuse me. But I got it, you know. Sorry. To me, I mean, sobriety, is important, but that's just the mile markers. You can have sobriety and have no recovery, and it doesn't mean the thing. It's like you're a dry drunk, you're miserable, you're just checking off on the calendar, oh, hey, I didn't drink today. It's like, yeah, but what are you doing in your life? You're just, you're sitting there miserable, and, you know, I know some people like that, too.
Yeah. Yeah, just sobriety, but not really any serenity is what I would call it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's where, you know, I was going to get into a little discussion on addiction as being a brain imbalance or a brain chemical imbalance. I'm not really going to do that, I don't think, at this point. But, you know, there is a medical reason that I'm not fully capable of understanding at this point about why the brain does kind of malfunction and create the addictive craving. But, you know, one way that craving is lessened is through the practice of meditation. And in the 12 steps, you know, that's one of the steps that I think is overlooked in a lot of groups is the 11th step. You know, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. And I don't know why, but the 20 or 30 years I was messing around with the program, I never got down to step 11. I was focused on steps 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then by the time I got down to step 4, I was scared and went right back to the addictive behavior. I never got down to get to step 11, but I really think now that step 11, you know, we should point that out right in the very beginning and saying, you know, you may be on steps 1, 2, and 3, but, you know, work in step 11 here too, because it calm the mind, give you that source of serenity, and just get you on a good footing for some serious recovery, I think.
Yeah. I mean, some people think that you know, it's you do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, then go to 11, and it's like, not necessarily. I mean, I've done one or two amends, and I'm nowhere near 8 and 9. I mean, I'm still at 6, you know,
yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, it happened. And one of them was my ex-wife over, you know, something. She's like, hey, Mark, I forgave you. That's in the past. That's in the dark stuff. Don't worry about it. I was just like, whoa. I mean, that just, I mean, I'm, 5 years ago, she would chase me around the house with a kitchen knife. Rightfully so, I might add. I mean, but now it's like, you know, we're not, I mean, we couldn't be married to save either one's soul. And that's good because I think my current wife would have something to say about that. But we get along better than we did in the last couple of years in the marriage. It's like, hey, you know, just don't have us living together or married and we'll do fine, you know. But, you know, she understood I was sick, and she's happy for me that I found recovery. And that means a lot because, I mean, I put her through hell. And
yeah.
That I'm still working on forgiving myself for that. But I'm doing a lot better than I was 6 months ago with it. So it's progress, not perfection.
That's it. Yeah, just one day at a time, making progress.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's one of the mistakes, big mistakes I think I made as early in the program is I always thought, and I don't know where this thought came from, but that you had to work the steps 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, in order,
right.
You know, 1 through 12, and I was very dogmatic on that. And it wasn't until, like you said, I started breaking the steps up, just doing what my sponsor said I should be doing, what I felt, you know, what I felt I had to do.
Yeah.
And I towards the end, you know, my sponsor and I were pretty much on the same page, which was a real blessing because earlier I was fighting my sponsor tooth and toenail. But yeah, just take it, you know, do as your sponsor says, do as the Spirit says, and just take it seriously.
Well, dude, I hate to break this up, but I need to get going. So, I mean, thanks for having me, and I think we solved the world's problems, don't you?
I think we got a good start on it. I think, yeah.
Okay,
well, Mark, thank you for being on the show. I appreciate having you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, you take care.
You
I'm going to play a musical clip, and I'll be back later.
Just as mine, oh, you.
All right. Well, welcome to part two of the tonight's broadcast. This is Frater Ralph, and I think in this segment I'd like to kind of hit on the idea that alcoholism, addiction, whatever your addiction is, does seem to be like a hopeless disease or a hopeless affliction. And a lot of folks think that this is so hopeless, they don't even try to get better. They think that perhaps they've tried so many times and failed, they think that it's pointless. And I know that we've had a few folks in our circle of influence here that have died and just gone to their graves practicing their addiction. And the point I'd like to get across here in this last half is that the disease of addiction, whatever addiction you may have, is not hopeless. It may seem hopeless, but once you hit upon a plan of action, a program of recovery, once you realize that this is not a moral failing, and that this is a clinical disease that has a cure, well, not really a cure, but a treatment, there is hope. You find that there is hope. And what makes an addict, at least according to some research that I've done, I'm referring here to the work of Dr. Ronald Rudin, the craving brain, is that what the addict has is a brain chemistry imbalance. You know, we have two brain chemicals, dopamine and serotonin, as well as a few others. But in the minds of normal people, dopamine is released into the brain to promote craving. And this is a healthy thing in the brains of normal people, because if you haven't eaten for several hours or several days, the body realizes that it needs food. And so dopamine will be released into the brain to create the craving for food. Or if you haven't drank water, you know, in a few hours or, again, a few days, the dopamine is released into the bloodstream. And it tells the brain, hey, we need water. Go out and get water. And then after the person has either eaten something or drank something, the body then releases serotonin. And serotonin is a chemical that affects the brain that says, hey, you've had enough. It's time to quit eating, or it's time to quit drinking. And serotonin is a brain chemical that tells the brain, hey, you're satisfied. You've done it. Congratulations. Mission accomplished. Now quit. And in the brains of addicts, there is an imbalance between those two chemicals, dopamine and serotonin. In the healthy brain, these two chemicals do a well-organized dance. You know, when you need something, the dopamine says, okay, go out and get it. And then when you've gotten that, when you got what you need, the serotonin says, okay, enough. You know, you've got what you need. Now go on to something else. And in the brain of the alcoholic or addict, the dopamine is there. You know, it's telling the brain, you know, you need this, you need this, you need this. And the serotonin, on the other hand, for some reason, is not there. You know, it may be there, but in quantities that are just too small to overcome the dopamine. So whereas in the brain of a healthy person, the dopamine is saying, okay, go out there and, you know, get what you need, get a hamburger, eat. And then the serotonin is released into the bloodstream and says, okay, you've had enough, quit eating. In the mind of the brain of the addict, the dopamine is going on a rampage saying, okay, eat, 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 drink, 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 you know, keep on going. And the serotonin isn't there in the right proportions to let the brain know, hey, it's time to quit eating, or it's time to quit drinking. And so that's where we see the out-of-control behavior in the life of the addict is that their brains are literally stuck on feed me, feed me, feed me. And they never really do get the signal that, hey, it's time to quit. It's time to stop. You've had enough. And that's been put forth as a theory by Dr. Ronald Rudin as to why, you know, when it comes to an alcoholic, you know, one beer leads to two, leads to three, leads to four, leads to five, and they never really do get satisfied until they pass out. And whereas with a healthy person, you know, he's craving a beer, he has one beer, and that's it. That's enough. That's enough to satisfy. Because the brain chemicals in the healthy brain are there to say, hey, you've had enough. Now, in the addictive brain, the craving brain, as Dr. Rudin calls it, the serotonin is not there in, you know, the serotonin just isn't doing the job for whatever reason, and the dopamine is running amok. Now, how do you bring this brain chemistry under control? And this is the beauty part. According to the research, and this is what AA hit on way back in the 1920s, 1930s, when they were first working the program out, this brain chemistry can be brought under control by abstinence from the behavior or from the drug of choice and meditation. Meditation helps to restore the balance between these two brain chemicals. Now, I don't understand why, but I do know from my own personal experience that it does work. And when I was practicing the 12 steps of AA and decided to adopt the practice of meditation and to try to treat my addiction through following the 12 steps and meditating three times a day, about 3 hours a day, I didn't really understand why, but the cravings diminished. I was given the serenity that I needed to get through part of the day. You know, I would meditate early in the morning, and that would give me the strength I needed to make it from morning to lunch. And then I would meditate for a half hour during my lunchtime, and that would give me the strength that I needed to go from lunch to the end of my day, to dinner time. And then after dinner, I would meditate again, and that would give me the calmness and the serenity I would need to be able to go through the evening without a drink and to go to bed feeling relatively serene, relatively happy, and sober. But it's all, as far as I understand this, it's all about balance. And you know, what we can do to restore a healthy balance in the brain is to, of course, meditate. Another thing that medical doctors recommend is a healthy, balanced diet. And that's something that seems like it's harder and harder to come by in our busy world. Back in the 1930s, when the folks in AA were working out the 12-step program, the first 12-step program that I'm aware of anyway, people ate real food. You know, you had soup, you had meat, you had potatoes, you had vegetables, you had fruit, and people actually knew how to cook. Today, we tend to eat out of boxes. If we cook, you know, we pick up a box dinner or macaroni and cheese, and we eat out of a box. And, of course, in the box dinners, the box meals, we have a little bit of food mixed with a whole lot of chemicals. You know, and in the 30s, when you were making macaroni and cheese, you cooked macaroni, you got the cheese, you mixed it with milk, made a cheese sauce, and you had macaroni and cheese that was made out of macaroni, milk, and cheese. Today, you know, we pick up a box, and we make up macaroni and cheese, and sure, it's got some macaroni in there. It's got some hydrogenated fat or milk solids or whatever they call it, variety of chemicals, flavorings, natural and artificial. You know, we don't know what the heck's in a lot of our food. And, you know, we've gone from being carnivores and herbivores to really becoming chemivores. We eat chemicals in our diet, a lot of them, more so than what we realize. And so I believe this contributes to an out-of-balance brain, you know, if you're trying to bring your brain chemistry under control. You need to be getting your right diet, your right foods, your right exercise. And we're just filling our bodies with sugar and fat and a whole bunch of junk, but stuff that will not contribute to a healthy balance within the brain chemistry or a healthy body or a healthy outlook on life. You know, and God, we can eat a whole bunch of this chemically enhanced food and not really feel satisfied because we're not eating real food. We're eating chemicals. And so meditation I found to be very helpful in my own program of recovery, eating a balanced diet, and just keeping away from substances or behaviors that you have found to be addictive in your own lifestyle. Now, with me, my biggest addiction was to alcohol. I was a problem alcoholic drinker for about 30 years, and I got to the point where that problem was just so bad, it was no longer a problem. It was threatening to end my life. And so I finally decided it was time to quit. It was time to adopt a program of recovery. With me, it was AA, an online AA, and the 12 steps, combined with a very heavy emphasis on meditation. And that worked. But we just have to make that decision. But the thought I'd like to leave the listener with at this point is that no matter how hopeless your situation seems, you don't have this affliction because you are any less of a person. You don't have this addiction because of some moral failing or because you're broken and you can't be fixed. You have this addiction quite possibly so you can learn from it and grow from it. In the beginning, we look at alcoholism and addiction as the problem. But after we learn how to deal with it and how to face it, we begin to realize that, hey, this is a golden opportunity for spiritual growth. I'm going to take a break and play something by Mojo Radio, Dreaming.
Saying your name, as I didn't want to lose the blame in this crazy game. Whoa, whoa. I go crazy. Yeah. that's left is aftertaste, which I save on week by week till she can live on. Will it fall now back in place? 'Cause I'm still
okay, in that last episode, we covered that alcoholism or addiction in general is a sickness, a disease associated with an imbalance of the brain. Now, we can also see addiction as being a spiritual sickness, a soul sickness. And that's where we can begin to see addiction as being not just a problem, but also an opportunity, because most people going through this life have a soul sickness. They just don't know what to call it. It doesn't manifest itself in the way that it does in the life of the addict. Most people can have this soul sickness and not realize that they're sick, and not really realize that they need something to help treat their soul sickness. Now, in the life of the alcoholic or the addict, we are really blessed because we know we have a soul sickness. It manifests itself in such a way where we absolutely cannot deny that we have this soul sickness, and we begin to realize we absolutely have to do something, in order to treat this soul sickness. And so we literally are forced into a spiritual life where we have to go through our spiritual practice, the program, grow spiritually, learn from our mistakes, face our mistakes, correct our mistakes as best we can with the help of the divine, as we understand the divine and those around us who are there to help, and make progress, just one day's progress in one day's time. And when we enter into a spiritually based program of recovery, and by that I mean, you know, any 12-step group that's worth its salt is a spiritually based program of recovery. You get some folks that don't quite get the spiritual aspect of the program, but, you know, it's there. And in a good group, they know it, and they know how to walk the person through it. But once you get into a spiritually based program of recovery and you begin the task of growing spiritually, you find that this problem, this addiction, begins to straighten itself out. And we do that, you know, through facing our failures, facing our problems, taking responsibility for our life, asking for help, turning our life over to our higher power as we understand that higher power, and humbly enter into communion with this higher power, asking for guidance, asking for help, asking for strength, and then taking that strength that we're given and going into action, acting upon, you know, the gifts that we are given. And then when we get down to step 11, which actually can be undertaken at any time, we begin to seek on a daily basis, sometimes 3 or 4 times a day or 5 times a day or more, we seek on a daily basis through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with the divine as we understand the divine, praying only for knowledge of this spirit's will for us and the power to carry that out. And when we get to that point where we are able to do that, face our problems honestly, take responsibility for our past misbehaviors and our past mistakes, and just take this directly to our higher power and improve our conscious contact through prayer and meditation. Now we begin the process of growing spiritually. And I'm firmly convinced this is why we have the problem of addiction in our society. This is why some of us have been chosen for this job of being a recovering addict, is that when you are an addict, spirituality and spiritual growth, these are not options. These are our lifelines. You know, we have to grow spiritually. If we don't, we die. Now, the average person, they may not have to grow spiritually. They can be a materialist from cradle to grave and not think anything wrong of it, not have any problems with it, maybe have a very long and happy, seemingly happy life. But for those of us with the disease of addiction, living a spiritual life is our only hope of survival. It's our only way of dealing with the problem of addiction. And it's our only way of having a happy, well-balanced life. And so that's where we get the idea of folks that have been into a program of recovery for quite a few years, going from the attitude of, oh, woe is me, I'm sick, I don't know why did God do this to me? Going from that bitter, spiteful addict to being a grateful addict. Being able to look back and saying, look, I've been through this hell, I managed to learn from it, I've grown from it, and I understand why now I was chosen for this task, or why I chose this task. It was so I could enter into a program of recovery, a program of spiritual growth that I otherwise would never have found had I been born a normal person. And that's a word of hope that I'd like to leave us on here for this broadcast, is that if you are suffering from addiction, it may seem hopeless. It may seem terrible. And, you know, in a certain way of thinking, it is. You know, when you go through the things that you go through, it does seem hopeless. It does seem terrible. But there's a reason for it. And there is an opportunity for growth that's contained in this illness. The main thing you have to do is just admit that you have this addiction and decide that you want to do something about it. And then when you make that decision that it's time to learn, it's time to grow, it's time to seek help, there are all sorts of agencies that you can contact for help. You can go online and look up AA.org for Alcoholics Anonymous, NA for Narcotics Anonymous. I don't know what their website is. Sex Addicts Anonymous, SAA-recovery.org, is their website. And Gamblers Anonymous, you can look them up on the line, internet. I don't have a website for them right now, but no matter what your problem is, no matter what your addiction is, you can find a 12-step group for it. Just go to the computer or look it up on your smartphone. If you still use a telephone book, you can probably find help there. And contact somebody. Get involved with a group. The tendency that we have as addicts is to isolate, to think that we are the only person on the face of the earth that has this problem, and we tend to isolate and just beat ourselves up over the problem or indulge in the problem. But when we begin to realize that there are others out there just like us, and we reach out for help, then we can get help, and we can begin to make progress. But it's all just a matter of taking it seriously, one day at a time, seeking help, seeking sobriety, and reaching out and accepting that help when we find it. And we may not particularly enjoy the help when it comes our way. Sometimes sponsors, we don't agree with them. Sometimes groups that we get involved with, we think, they're just full of baloney, they're full of hot air. Nobody there knows what they're talking about. I'm better off on my own. And then you go off on your own and you relapse and you realize that, hey, those guys in that group, they actually know what they're talking about. But, you know, reach out for the help, accept the help, and take it seriously. And all manner of growth is possible. You know, there is hope. And some of us, we can be pretty stubborn. We can think that we've got it all under control. And for those of you who are, you know, involved in the life of an addict, you know, you can see that. You can see them constantly going back out and indulging in their addiction and wondering, you know, how many times do they have to beat themselves up before they finally get it? But, you know, some of us are pretty stubborn. But after a while, things begin to come together. Things begin to seep into our alcoholic, addictive brains, and things begin to make sense. But it just takes time. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink the water. But you can make sure the water's there. I'm going to wrap this broadcast up, and I don't know what we're going to be talking about on our next broadcast this coming Tuesday. But I'd like to thank you all for listening in. This broadcast is brought to you by the Temple of the Infinite Universe Incorporated, an interfaith spiritual outreach located in Wheatland, Missouri, and accessible worldwide through the Internet. To learn more about us, check out our website, www.hermetictemple.com. If you would like to support these broadcasts and our other temple activities, you can visit our GoFundMe page at www.gofundme.com/temple building. And you can also connect with us on Facebook by liking our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/temple of the infinite. Until later, this is Frater Ralph wishing you blessings. And until we meet again, have a blessed evening of discovery.